It struck me as I was preparing this morning that this April, this coming April, we will have been meeting here at this venue having these type of meetings for 6 years. And I share this because what I'm going to be speaking on this morning, and this is just my opinion, is probably one of the most important messages I've given. And I just share that because for me, it's meant the most to me personally, the preparation, the thinking through it, because this is what, to me, makes life coherent. And it also explains, as we look around the landscape of life, it helps us understand just what's going on around us and also maybe what goes on in our own personal lives. Now, after you've heard the message, you may not agree with what I've said if you've been to a number of these meetings, but again, this to me personally is just a very significant message. And where I want to start is with a story of an incident that took place well over 50 years ago in the early 1950s in the life of Dr. R.C. Sproul. I don't know if you're familiar with him. He is a very prominent theologian, teacher. He's in his mid to late 70s now, and he tells about, as a college student, taking on a summer job. He lived in Pittsburgh, and he was a philosophy major in college. I don't remember where he went to school. But he shows up for the first day of work at this summer job at this large hospital, and they ask him what he's studying in college as they try to figure out what they're going to do with him. And he says, when I told them that I was a philosophy major, they handed me a broom and said, you're in charge of keeping the parking lot and the grounds clean this summer. And he says, so for the entire summer, I spent my time outside sweeping the parking lot, this huge facility, and keeping the grounds clean. And he said, ironically, next door was this huge office building. And he said, I began to notice there was an old elderly gentleman that was kind of doing the same duties that I was doing, but on the premises of this office building. And he said, one day, as we kind of were close to each other, we stopped and had a brief conversation. And he said, the man asked me several questions. He said, what are you studying in college? And when I told him philosophy, he just kind of lit up, and he started asking me questions. And he said, I began to realize that this man knew more about philosophy than anybody I had ever met or who I had ever listened to in college. This guy knew more about philosophy than any of my professors, and yet here he was pushing a broom. He said he then proceeded to tell me his story. As it turned out, he was German. He had a PhD in philosophy and for years had taught at the University of Berlin. He said, but when Hitler came to power, the Nazis sought to remove all professors whose ideas were at odds with the values of the Third Reich. And he said, I lost my job. He said, so I began to speak out against Hitler, against what was going on in Germany. And he said, one day I came home and they had taken my wife and all of but one of my children and taken them. And they eventually went to a death camp and were executed. And somehow this man and his daughter were able to escape and somehow made it to America. And he said, as he was telling the stories, he got to then, he said he had tears in his eyes and he said, I'll never teach philosophy again because it had destroyed his loved ones and it had ruined his life. And Sproul says, you know, I vividly can remember this conversation here some 50 years later. And he says, what it's made me realize, he says, is that we live in a culture that gives little thought to our ideas. He said, but this man was pushing a broom because he lived in a culture that gave great weight to a person's ideas about life. He said, this man's family was destroyed because Hitler understood that ideas can be very dangerous. And he said, Hitler so feared the consequences of this man's ideas that he did everything possible to eliminate him and his ideas. Now, I'm not sure if you've given this much thought, but every single one of us lives with a certain set of ideas about life. And out of these ideas, we develop what I call a philosophy of life. Again, we may not realize it, but we all have one. You see what happens? We all enter into this world and begin to try and make sense out of this world around us. And you know, I see this in my oldest son, who's almost 10. He's very curious. He's always asking me questions. Last night he was asking me about education and going to school. And what happens is, as we grow older, we begin to develop certain ideas about how life works. And it's these set of ideas that ultimately governs our thinking and tells us what the world is like and how we should live in it. I want to share with you a quote from Dallas Willard. And before I do, I want to just mention this because I'm going to quote him a couple of times. Willard, there was a long interview with him in Christianity Today recently. He is one of the most prominent philosophy professors in this country. He teaches at the University of Southern California, USC. He's written a number of books. In fact, he's on sabbatical right now writing a book. But he shares this thought. He says, "Our ideas are the assumptions we have about reality. They are the ways we think about and interpret life. They are so pervasive and essential to how we think about and approach life that we often do not even know that they're there or understand when and how they are at work. Therefore," he says, "it is extremely difficult for most people to recognize which ideas are governing their life and how those ideas are governing their lives." Think about these words. Think about these words. Love, friendship, marriage, pleasure, happiness, freedom, money, material possessions, success, knowledge, pain and suffering, God, Jesus, death, heaven, hell. You know, these are very important issues in our lives, and every single one of us has certain beliefs and ideas on each one of these. And though we may never have articulated our actual views, they do exist. Now, this leads me really to what I want to talk about. This is kind of setting it up as a way of introduction. In fact, what I'm here to share with you has been so important to me personally that it's become the philosophical foundation for my approach to counseling men about their problems and about their struggles. And it comes from a single quote from Blaise Pascal. And let me share that quote with you. He says that this is written 350 years ago. He says, "Human beings find life to be unsatisfying and incoherent as time goes by because they have false beliefs and false ideas on matters important for living a high quality of life. Therefore, it's critical that we gain genuine wisdom by uprooting false beliefs," uprooting false beliefs, he says, "and replacing them with true insights and perspective." You see what he's saying? He's saying our ideas about life are so powerful because ultimately they impact our decisions and our choices and our priorities. And he says if our ideas about reality are false, it'll have a negative impact on my life experience. Now, what's interesting as a side note, and I'm just going, this may not be of interest to anybody, but I thought as I was preparing this, you would find it of some interest, that what I've just said is how Western philosophy got started. You see, Plato contended that certain philosophical ideas are true and others are false. And he said philosophy's goal is to search for that infallible, certain knowledge that is so critically important to society. In fact, that's why his mentor, Socrates, was executed. He had to drink the hemlock because he was teaching the youth of Athens that there were certain universal truths that applied to all of life and all of society. And the adults in Athens thought he was corrupting their kids. You know, even Jesus warns us of the dangers of living with false ideas. And he specifically addresses it in two different places. One in the Sermon on the Mount and another in Luke chapter 11. And I want to read this to you. It's just three verses. But listen to it. And when I read it, at first glance, you may think, what in the world is he talking about? Let me read it and then I'm going to explain. He says, "The eye is the lamp of the body. And when your eye is clear, your whole body also is full of light. But when it is bad, your body also is full of darkness." Then he says, "Watch out that the light in you is not darkness. If therefore your whole body is full of light with no dark part in it, it will be wholly illumined as when the lamp illumines you with its rays." In fact, verse 35 is always kind of perplexing. And what he's really saying there is, make sure the light that you think you have is not really darkness. Now, when I first read these verses, these three verses, I had no idea what he was talking about. But then after I did a little research, it became so clear. He's saying the eye is what we see life through. In the spiritual realm, it's how we perceive reality. It's the lens through which we see life. Furthermore, Jesus is revealing that our ideas about life, our perceptions of reality, can be rooted in falsehood. And he says, if it is, he says, our lives will be full of darkness and we'll stumble through life. But he goes on to say, they can be rooted in truth, and when this happens, our lives will be full of light and we will have the ability to walk in wisdom. Now, Stephen Covey, who many of you I'm sure are familiar with, who has written probably the one business book, if you want to consider it a business book, it's really on personal living, that sold more copies than any other book ever written in that realm, The Seven Habits of Highly Effective People, which I know many of you have read. But at the heart of the book, he talks about how our ideas about life form what he calls a worldview or a paradigm. And he says this paradigm forms the way we see the world, not in terms of our visual sense of sight, but in terms of perceiving, understanding, and interpreting life. And then he gives a great illustration. He says, imagine that you're going to the city of Chicago. You've never been there before. And so you need a map. And you're in your hotel and you go up front and you say, I need a map of Chicago, and they give you one. But in essence, what they give you without realizing is that the printer had made a mistake, and it's a map of the city of Detroit that says Chicago across the top. And he says, you know, imagine trying to go out into the city of Chicago, trying to find a certain museum, a certain restaurant, and you're looking at your map and you're trying to make your way to that destination. He says, you'll never get there. He says, and you don't know why. Because you got the wrong map. He says, you know, and what a lot of people do, instead of trying to get the right map, he says, they try harder. I got to be more diligent. But let me ask you something. Being more diligent in getting around in Chicago with the map of Detroit will not help you at all. He says, a second approach people take is, I'm going to change my attitude. That'll be helpful. I'll change my attitude. He says, but if you change your attitude but still have the wrong map, you'll continually be lost. And the point Covey tries to make is this. He says, most people today are trying to live their lives in Chicago with a map of Detroit. You know, it's interesting. I shared this illustration with a young man who came to my office about 3 weeks ago who I'm meeting with. He's 35 years old, and he's had a hard time in life. And I used this illustration, and I shared it with him, and it was like a light went on in his life. He says, that's me. That's my life. I've been trying to live in Chicago with a map of Detroit. And the good news is, he wants the right map. He wants his life to be right. He wants his marriage to be right. And he realizes he's been going down the wrong path. C.S. Lewis shares something very similar to what Covey has said. And this is from this wonderful little book called The Most Reluctant Convert, C.S. Lewis's Journey to Faith. And he shares a story of what happened to him when he first arrives at Oxford as a student. Now, I'm not sure how much you know about Lewis's life, but for 31 years he was an atheist. He believed Christianity to be mythological. And then a major transformation takes place in his life, and he shares a true story that he saw as an allegory of his life. Now listen to the story. This happened to him right when he arrived at Oxford. Lewis's first experience in the renowned university town was a comical one, but also, he felt, a deeply significant one. He reports that he came out of the railway station loaded down with luggage, headed down the street in the wrong direction, away from the college. He kept walking, increasingly disappointed by the frowsy houses and shops he saw, until he came near to the edge of the city. Only when he saw that he was on the outskirts of town and entering the countryside did he turn around, and there spread before him, never more beautiful since, was the fabled cluster of spires and towers of Oxford. At that point, he realized he had gone the wrong way, turning his back on his true destination. In recounting this episode, Lewis concludes that this little adventure was an allegory of my whole life. Lewis read this incident as an allegory of his life because it showed that for too long he had been walking in the wrong direction. You see, Lewis, for 31 years of his life, thought he knew where he was going. He thought what he believed was true, but then later he acknowledged, I was dead wrong. And I love what he says. I had turned my back on my true destination. He said, without realizing it, I turned my back on where I really wanted to go. Now, you may wonder this morning why I would think this message is so important and so significant. But I do think it's critical, and I'm going to share with you why. There's an author and a lecturer by the name of James Sir. S-I-R-E. He's written a number of books. I just ordered one yesterday. And he spends his life now conducting a seminar at universities throughout the country, maybe even throughout the world. And it's a seminar, and they say he packs it out with college students. And when they promote the seminar, the seminar is called Why Should Anyone Believe Anything at All? And he begins the seminar by asking this question. He says, why do people believe what they believe? That's good. Have you ever thought about, why do I believe what I believe? You know, how do we arrive at our beliefs? That's what he's trying to ask these college students. And then he says, there are four categories that impact our thinking and our ideas and our beliefs. We have the sociological influence, a psychological influence, religious influence, and philosophical influence. And then he kind of takes the Socratic method and he asks questions and interacts with the students out in the audience. And then he brilliantly demonstrates to them several points, but one of the points he drives home is this, and that he wants them to take away, and that is this. Truth is important because there can be consequences when you're wrong. And then he goes on to demonstrate that over the long run, truth protects us and error harms us. Now, guys, what concerns me most as I look into men's lives is that false beliefs can be a real problem because we often are not aware that what we believe is false until we get burned by the belief. And I think about as an illustration something that recently took place out in the physical realm. That very tragic airplane crash in Kentucky a few weeks ago. Now here you have a pilot with a plane full of people sitting on the runway, convinced that he is getting ready to take off down the runway that he's supposed to go down. He believed all was well. The plane was in good condition. He was ready to take off. And without realizing, he was supposed to be on a runway that was 6,000 feet, and he was on a runway that was 3,000 feet. And he took off with no concerns, confident that he was going in the right direction, only to find when he got to the end of that 3,000-foot runway that he had made a horrible mistake. You see, he realized the mistake when it was too late. And he tried to go over the trees, and he couldn't, and crashed, and he killed everyone. Listen again to the words of Dallas Willard. And then I'm going to bring this into our lives in a more practical manner. This has all been kind of theory. I want to talk about how this practically applies to our lives. But listen to what Willard says. He says, why do people find their lives in chaos and their souls running amok? One of the primary reasons is that they are blinded by false ideas, distorted images, and misinformation, so that their souls cannot find its way into a life of consistent truth and a harmonious pursuit of what is good. They become locked in a self-destructive struggle with themselves and with all that is around them. And he says the most prominent features in their lives are unfulfilled desires and poisoned relationships. And then he says, so often when he counsels people, he says, I'm stunned by the reasons people give me for clinging to their false beliefs. Now, how does this apply to my life? I could go into a multitude of directions, but I just want to focus in on one, since this is a group of men. And I want to draw my thoughts from this book that many of you have read. If you've in one of the Bible studies that I teach, you've read this book. And if you haven't, it's called Seasons of Life. And it's about a football team, a high school football team. And it's about a coach, Joe Ehrman. And it's his attempt to teach young teenage boys how to be men. I don't know if you remember Ehrman. He was an All-American defensive tackle at Syracuse and then went on to be All-Pro at the Baltimore Colts. There was a huge write-up about him and what he's doing with these young men in Parade magazine. But the major thrust of the book is this, that most young men's ideas about masculinity are false. He calls it false masculinity. Listen to what he says. It's quite interesting. He says, as young boys, we're told to be men or to act like men. And once you start getting close to adolescence, you get that verbalized pretty quickly. But the problem is that in this society, in most homes, it's never defined. We've got all these parents saying, be a man to boys that have no concept of what that means. Most of the fathers don't have any grip on a definition, so how could the sons possibly know what's expected of them? And then the author, Jeffrey Marks, who wrote this book, says, Joe told me about a simple exercise he often uses when directing men's workshops. He hands out note cards and asks the participants to write a definition of masculinity. Most men are absolutely dumbfounded by the question. They really don't write anything at all. Or it ends up being a definition based on some kind of functional or material thing, getting a good job or something like that. Sometimes he asks boys to answer the same question. With kids, it's always about some kind of strength or power stuff, Joe said. It's always about some kind of capacity to control. He says, if you don't get some kind of clear, compelling definition of masculinity at home, then you're pretty much left at the mercy of this society and the messages that are going to speak to masculinity and manhood. And he says, this is how most young men develop their ideas about masculinity and manhood. And he says, that's why so many of them end up being so dysfunctional as they move into adulthood. Now, then he goes on and starts about, and he tells about what is false masculinity. He says you see it in three stages. He starts in your early life with athletic performance. I know there are a lot of men in here with young sons, and you can see how that is. Our sons think, I've got to be a great athlete. That's what it's all about. Then as they move on into adolescence and the teenage years, he says it's sexual conquest and success with the opposite sex, that's what defines a man. And then as they move into adulthood, he says, it's economic and financial success. That's what masculinity is all about. And he says, this is false. And then he draws on the biblical understanding of manhood. And he says, masculinity, first and foremost, ought to be defined in terms of our relationships. It ought to be taught in terms of the capacity to love and be loved. If you look over your life at the end of it, life wouldn't be measured in terms of success based on what you've acquired or achieved or what you own. The only thing that's really going to matter is the relationships you've had. He said, secondly, I think the second criteria is that all of us ought to have some kind of cause, some kind of purpose, some kind of mission in our lives that's bigger than our own individual hopes, dreams, wants, and desires. And finally, he says, he spoke about several elements of a code of conduct for men. And he gets into the issue of character and character development and who we are as men. Not what we perform, but who we are. Guys, do you see how a young man's ideas about masculinity impacts his life? Just think about how healthy young teenage boys would be if their ideas of what a real man is was rooted in this truth. But what about us? As we sit here this morning, what about us? What is our view of true masculinity? You know, as I look around the room, I doubt there are very few of us who get it from our athletic past. Talking about what we did athletically, feeling like that's what makes us men. Or how well we were in the past at attracting women. And yet I wonder how many men today, maybe even sitting in this room, measure their lives by business achievement and financial success. You know, this reminds me of what many consider to be the greatest American play ever written by Arthur Miller back in 1949. It won a Pulitzer Prize, Death of a Salesman. I don't know if you're familiar with it. You may have seen the movie with Dustin Hoffman. But it's a story of Willie Loman. Willie Loman was an insurance salesman. And he had been seeking business success all of his life. And he's always trying to impress others. He's always trying to be a big shot, trying to impress his sons. But the problem is he has a very dysfunctional family, and he's really not very successful. He's quite mediocre. And then at the end of the play, he gets fired from his job, and it dawns on him. In his mind, I've been a failure. And he ends the play, or the play ends, with Loman taking his life. And just after the funeral, Willie's wife says to their oldest son, Biff, Biff, why did he do it? Why did he do it? And Biff said, shucks, Ma. He had all the wrong dreams. He had all the wrong dreams. You know, I share this because I find that many men fall into the same trap Willie Loman fell into. They develop false ideas about what it means to live a successful life. And in Loman's case, it destroyed him. I remember years ago when he was kind of the business icon in our country, and he wrote his autobiography, Lee Iacocca. Fascinating book. But I'll never forget, at the very end of the book, he says this, I quote, "Here I am in the twilight years of my life, and I'm still wondering, what's it all about?" I can tell you this, fame and fortune is for the birds. Interestingly, as you read the book, what you realize is that his whole life, his idea of success was a life of fame and fortune. He achieves it, and at the end of his life he says, it's for the birds. Which makes me wonder, do we really know what life is all about? Many of you know one of my favorite quotes, and I use it a lot, but I'm going to share it in a little different context this morning, and I'm going to kind of take it apart. But to me, it's one of the greatest quotes that I've ever heard. And it comes from Alexander Solzhenitsyn. I don't know how familiar you are with Solzhenitsyn. He won a Pulitzer Prize for literature. He gave that famous but very controversial commencement address at Harvard in 1978, A World Split Apart. Solzhenitsyn went into prison. He was thrown into prison and spent 8 years in a Russian prison because he had written some disparaging remarks about Joseph Stalin. 8 years in prison. He went into prison as an atheist. He came out 8 years later as a committed Christian. And as he walked out of that prison, instead of being angry and bitter with what had happened to his life, this is what he says. He says, "I bless you, prison. I bless you for being in my life. For there, lying on rotting prison straw, I learned that the object of life was not prosperity, as I had grown up believing, but it is the maturing of the soul." Do you realize what happened? Here he is. He goes into prison believing that we live in a godless material universe and therefore the object of life is just prosperity. 8 years later, he comes out and his life had been transformed and his ideas about life were transformed because he had become a Christian and consequently realized that the real object of life has to do with issues of the soul, the character, the heart. And so this morning I would ask you to answer the question and ask yourself, what is the object of life? You know, what is life really all about? And am I on the right track? You know, when I look at Solzhenitsyn's life, and from all that I've observed in this life, and all that I've done, all that I've experienced, all that I've observed, I've come to this conclusion, that when a person is in a right relationship with God, and is seeking to know Him, and is connected with Him, it will impact all of his ideas about life. Why? Because our relationship with God, or the lack of our relationship with Him, is really the foundation of our thinking, and it's ultimately the foundation of our ideas. I don't know how many of you are familiar with Arnold Toynbee, very famous British historian, not a religious man. He authored the 12-volume series, A Study of History. He spent 27 years of his life on that. Imagine that. And what he did was a comparative study of 26 civilizations in world history. And listen to what he says. He says, "The crucial question confronting Western man are all religious questions when you get right down to it." He says, "Because of the inevitable dependence of a society's actions on its beliefs. He says, if its actions are destructive, we must ask what it believes that causes it to behave in such a way. And it just struck me as I was read that, you know, you look at what's going on over in Iraq. Do you not think that the terrorists act because of their view of God and their belief in God and their belief of what happens to them when they blow themselves up? This is why Solomon tells us in Proverbs 9:10, he says, our relationship with the Holy One, with God, is where we get true understanding about life. But if you think about it, as we look over the landscape in front of us, I think it is worthwhile to ask ourselves this question. Where did I get my ideas about life? Have you ever really thought about that? Where did I get my ideas? Where did I get my ideas about success, about relationships, about masculinity, about sexuality, about love, about happiness, about God, or any other important issue in life? Where did that come? How did I arrive at them? What are my sources? What ultimately has shaped my thinking? You know, C.S. Lewis believed that the only way to get this right, to have a life where my ideas and beliefs are rooted in the truth, he says, you need to have somebody that's trustworthy to guide you. And he believed the ultimate guide, the best guide out there, was Jesus Christ, the second person of the Trinity. Because you remember what Christ said? He says, I am the light of the world. You know, he didn't say, I am one of many lights or a light. He says, I am the light of the world. He who follows me will not walk in darkness, but will have the light of life. This is why John says, Jesus was the true light who, coming into the world, enlightens every man. You see, light, guys, illuminates. It enlightens us to what is true. And you know, it struck me this morning, if we don't look to Him as our God, as our guide, who will we look to? Who else is out there that can guide us into the truth? Now, I want to wrap this up with one final major point. And this struck me as I was preparing, that if you step back and look at the four Gospels, Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John, and you look at Jesus' teaching, you know, one of the things you'll note is that He continually warns us of and exposes us to the false ideas that humans commonly fall prey to. I did a study several years ago. One of the things I like to do is find an important word that you see in the Bible and look up every verse in there where that word is used. You know, I just kind of like to do that. And one of the words that I kept encountering and I decided to do a study on is the word beware. You know, that word's used often in the Bible. Beware. Do you know that term? It struck me that that's the word I'll probably use when my daughter goes out on her first date. Beware. But you know what? It's interesting. The number one issue that God warns us with that word beware, the number one issue, He says, beware of false teaching. Number one issue He warns us of, beware of false teaching, being taken in by false teaching. God is telling us it is deadly to have false assumptions in your spiritual life. And there are many other examples in Scripture. But let me just close with this one. Because there is a place in the Sermon on the Mount where Jesus exposes the most deadly false assumption a person can make in all of life. But this is my opinion. And it's in Matthew chapter 7. Verses 21 through 23. And Jesus speaks of people that have false assumptions about their spiritual life. Listen to these words. Matthew 7, 21 through 23. Not everyone who says to me, Lord, Lord, will enter the kingdom of heaven. But he who does the will of my Father who is in heaven will enter. Many will say to me on that day, but Lord, Lord, didn't we not prophesy in your name and cast out demons and in your name perform many wonderful works? And then I'll declare to them, I never knew you. Depart from me, you who practice lawlessness. What he's saying is, depart from me, you who are sinful. Now, what's this all about? What's he saying here? You know, notice he doesn't say, all atheists and non-believers will not enter the kingdom of God. What he says is, not everyone who calls me Lord, not everyone who believes in me, not everyone who professes me is God. Now, guys, these are hard words. And he says, on that day, on the judgment day, he says, there will be these people, and they're going to plead their case. They said, Lord, I believed in you, and I did all these wonderful things. And he said, it says, and I did them in your name. I did all these great religious works. And he says, depart from me. I never knew you. You know, as we consider these three verses, I guess the question is, what is the false assumption? What's the false idea? Well, clearly, the people Jesus is referring to out there in the future had a false understanding of salvation, or as Luke said, they lacked a true knowledge of salvation. You know, think about it. Jesus is speaking of those who acknowledge Him as God, they do good religious works, and in one sense, we're very much like the Pharisees. I mean, think about the Pharisees. They led an impeccable life as far as their behavior. They certainly believed in God. They did all the religious traditions, but this is the key, and this is the important insight I want to drive home. But what was Jesus' words to them? He says, you do honor me with your lips. You do honor me with your life. He says, the problem is, your heart is far from me. You see, ultimately, guys, it's an issue of the heart. And I love what, again, C.S. Lewis, what he recognized in his life, again from this book, The Most Reluctant Convert. He says this, you know, for years he struggled with the belief in God and whether Jesus was truly the Son of God. And through help with some of his friends like Tolkien, he finally arrived at the belief that God does exist and Jesus is the Son of God. It says, but at that point he also realized, let me just quote from the book. It says, at that point, it only remained for Lewis to surrender his will and his heart. But the problem was, it says, this was no small task, since he now felt he was not simply accepting a body of doctrines, but submitting to a living person. You see, Lewis realized that you not only have to believe it in your head, but you have to surrender your heart. He realized that Christianity was not a religion, but a relationship that must be entered into with a surrendered heart. And you know, this shouldn't surprise us because there's another relationship very similar to this in life, and that's marriage. You enter into it. It doesn't just happen. You enter into it. And you completely give yourself to your partner. Think about the words in the marriage ceremony that the church has used for centuries. Dearly beloved, we gather together here in the sight of God and these witnesses to join together this man and this woman in holy matrimony, which is an honorable state instituted of God, and listen to this, signifying the mystical union between Christ and His church. You see, the church has always recognized that marriage, which we understand, is a picture of what should take place between God and His people. The question is, and the question we all should ask, have we entered into that relationship, and do we really know Him personally? You know, interestingly, I know a local minister who shares that he was halfway through seminary before realizing that he was just like the people described in Matthew 7. I heard a priest speak, a very prominent man, and he said, I was ordained. I was teaching in the church. I was administering the sacraments. And I realized I was like those people in Matthew 7. I was spiritually lost, and I didn't know Christ. And then I have a real close friend today. He's a physician. If I mention his name, many of you know him. And he shared this with me. This happened a number of years ago. He said, you know, I was a good church-going family man. And he was. Until I was confronted, and I don't know if it was a sermon at church or at a setting like this, until I was confronted with these same verses in Matthew 7. And he said, when I heard those for the first time, I realized I was not a Christian and I did not know Jesus Christ. And what happened is that over a period of months, it led him to eventually surrendering his heart to Christ, which is what had been lacking in his life. Now, guys, again, these are hard words that Jesus gives us in Matthew 7. But my friend, the physician that I just mentioned, would tell you that these words were the greatest blessing in his life because they led him out of his false assumptions into what is true. I leave you with the words of Dallas Willard. In two or three sentences, he summarizes everything I've said this morning. I leave you with this. There is no avoiding the fact that we live at the mercy of our ideas. This is never more true than with our ideas about God. Meaning well, trying to live a good life is not enough. Those who operate on the wrong information are likely never to know the reality of God's presence in their lives or in the decisions and choices they make which shape their lives. And they will miss the constant divine companionship for which their souls were made. Guys, do we have that divine companionship in our lives? Do we really know Him? In Matthew 7, Jesus tells us that knowing Him is the true mark of a Christian. Let us close in prayer. Lord, we do thank You that You are the one who gives us truth, that You provide the lens of truth through which we can see life, through which we can form our ideas about life. Lord, help us to realize that there is a pattern and fabric to life and that You've called us to live in harmony with that fabric or pattern. But help us to realize, Lord, that You and only You are the guide. You're the only one that can truly guide us into what is true. And as we leave this morning, we do thank You, not only for Your truth, but for the lives You've given us, for our families, for all the wonderful friendships that exist in this room. And just for this time together, we are grateful. We do thank You in Christ's name. Amen.